Welcome to Minors Council 101, what you need to know when council is appointed. I'm Alla Policastro, CLE advisor for the Beverly Hills Bar Association. Today's program is presented by the Family Law Section. Our Family Law Section is sponsored by White, Zuckerman, Warsawski, Luna, and Hunt LLP. They provide a wide variety of resources to complete almost any project, large or small. They also provide traditional accounting and tax practice services. We invite you to contact them to discuss your specific accounting needs and learn how they can be of service to you. I'm delighted to introduce today's speakers, Judge Sonia B. Dujon and Commissioner Kendra Thomas. Judge Dujon is currently assigned to Department F48 at the Chatsworth Courthouse. Her judicial responsibilities primarily involve family law matters. She has a rich background in family law. Before her judicial appointment, she was in private practice for over 25 years and focused on custody issues and often served as minors counsel in family law and probate guardianship cases. Commissioner Thomas serves as a family law commissioner in the Los Angeles Superior Court, also at the Chatsworth Courthouse in Department F58. She presides over various family law matters and has been in that role since 2024. Commissioner Thomas has a rich background as a certified family law specialist. While she was in private practice, she founded her own firm and dedicated a significant part of her practice to representing children as court-appointed minors counsel. Commissioner Thomas previously served as co-chair of the BHBA Family Law Section and currently sits on our Board of Governors. Judge Dujon and Commissioner Thomas, we're so thankful that you're here with us today, and we can't wait to hear what you have to share with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ella. Okay, let me go ahead and share my screen. Okay, welcome, everyone. We are delighted to be here. Why don't we get started, Judge Dujon, with the purpose and the role of Minors Counsel?
Yes. Okay. So thank you for having us. This is about how to work with minors counsel. And it's important to start really at the beginning. What is the purpose? What is the role of minors counsel? And minors counsel, we'll get a little bit more into it, but it's the legal framework comes from Family Code sections 3150 through 3153. And it's important to note that minors counsel is an advocate for the child's best interest, and minors counsel comes at this from the child's perspective. So it's a third perspective. They come in as a neutral, but they don't necessarily remain as a neutral because they have a client to represent, and they'll zealously argue over for their client's best interest. And there's a difference, isn't there, Commissioner Thomas, between a minor's counsel, a guardian ad litem, a mediator,
Oh,
even
yes.
an evaluator. Can you talk a little bit about the differences, mostly between minors counsel and a guardian ad litem?
Oh, absolutely. In terms of a minors counsel, that is a legal advocate who is representing the child in the capacity of attorney. Guardian ad litem is a representative in a different capacity. And later on, you'll hear from Judge Dujon why the distinction is actually very important and why we really rely on not only the bench officer, but the other practitioners in the room to know the difference. Because when one is appointed as minors counsel, they are actually limited in their capacity. And when one is appointed as a guardian ad litem, that is a completely different hat completely. So I think it's going to be interesting to see. And we saw actually, there's a case that we'll be discussing in the last couple of years where this has become a very important distinction.
Yes, and it's also important if you're going into court and you're asking for minors counsel or you get minors counsel appointed, whether you ask for it or not, minors counsel is also not an evaluator. And a lot of times, I think attorneys for parties like to ask for minors counsel instead of an evaluator because it'll be quicker, because it might be less expensive. But it's really two very different roles, and one cannot be interchanged for the other.
Why
So,
not?
well, first of all, minors counsel is an attorney. An evaluator is a mental health professional. Different trainings, different purposes, different roles. And minors counsel really cannot go into court and give recommendations that are based on a psychological assessment of the family. That is not minors counsel's role or training. So one cannot be interchanged for the other. And I think a lot of times attorneys do ask for minors counsel instead of an evaluator, again, because of the cost and the time that it might take an evaluator to complete an evaluation. Minors counsel will represent the minor child's wishes and their best interest. Sometimes they're not aligned, but minors counsel, that's part of what they're charged for, is both best interest and expressed wishes of the minor. So,
Judge Dujon, if they don't align, which one governs?
well, that's really up to the court, isn't it? I really think that's up to the court because I think minors counsel presents both and the court decides. I think usually it's best interest. Especially when you've got teenagers that really just want to manipulate a situation, but it's usually best interest, but it's up to each judicial officer. My two cents. But where does the court get the authority to appoint minors counsel? And that's Family Code Section 3150. And the sections that follow, which is 3151, 3152, 3153, those are all important. And 3151 we'll get more into in a little bit, but it gives attorneys their rights and responsibilities for representing children. And 3153 governs how minors counsel are paid. So that's actually important for the people that are actually representing children. So why might a judge appoint minors counsel? Commissioner Thomas, what do you think?
Well, the absolute, I'm still struck by my first day in Chatsworth on my RFO calendar. The number of individual attorneys that I was hearing their matters, and as I was getting to my ruling, and it seemed like they may not be victorious, as kind of a Hail Mary, they shot up their hand and said, "Well, Your Honor, before you do that, we want minors counsel." And I laugh at it because I, fortunately, being someone who has represented hundreds of children in court, I was not necessarily in the courtroom at the time that that happened, if that's how I ended up getting appointed. But the realities are that it was the first time I really needed to look at why I would appoint a minors counsel. Now, I know Judge Dujon, I think I'm in the minority on this. I use minors counsel probably more sparingly than the other judicial officers that I know. I have a very, very interesting ethos in terms of when I want minors counsel appointed, what I'm looking for. And what I'm looking for when I'm appointing minors counsel is, what is it? What information or advocacy do I need from a third party for this child to be represented? So, merely because there's conflict involving the child, that's not enough for me to say, okay, let me go ahead and get a minors counsel involved. But I specifically want to understand what advocacy I need that's best served by this child having independent counsel. Many times that could be parents who are engaged in high conflict. That could be allegations of abuse, neglect, domestic violence. To the extent that a child is expressing a strong wish or is resisting visitation, there may be something that I feel independent advocacy would be helpful. If there are, allegations of mental health, substance abuse, capacity concerns, or sometimes I just want an independent individual focused on the child to bring me admissible evidence. Because quite frankly, at the time that I'm making these decisions, I need to make whatever custody and visitation orders I make based on admissible evidence. And to the extent there's any type of complex medical, education, or cultural issue that I don't feel either parent or their counsel is in a position to address from the vantage point of the child, that's when I'm looking at that third party perspective or advocacy could be helpful. Judge Dujon, what about you?
No, I agree. I think those are all issues that may give rise to the appointment of minors counsel. I think there's also, I'll consider it whether when there's an issue of privilege, whether the minor child's privilege regarding their mental health treatment or their medical treatment should be waived or not waived. I'll appoint minors counsel maybe, or if there is some DCFS involvement, and sometimes there needs to be more information. Dependency hasn't filed a petition, opened a case, but there's DCFS involvement, and I may need some independent person that comes in as an independent to gather information as to what is happening, why the situation is giving rise to DCFS involvement, or if I need information from the child's perspective, right? A lot of times I feel that I may need some more input from the child's perspective, and I'll appoint an attorney to help them. Or if there's a trial where the child may testify on the issues of custody and visitation, and it's just to represent the child while they're testifying. It's just to get them ready to testify and assist them when they're testifying. But otherwise, a lot of the issues that Commissioner Thomas mentioned are also issues that I think would give rise possibly to the appointment of minors counsel.
As a practical matter, you mentioned that when privilege issues are at stake, that's when you will consider appointing a minors counsel. At the point you make that appointment, how does that factor into the privilege? And who holds the privilege once you appoint minors counsel?
So, minors counsel, and we're pursuant to Family Code 3151, and we'll see it later a little bit too. They can assert or waive privilege on behalf of the minor child. So, if there's an issue of privilege and the parents are arguing, and I think that perhaps the minor child's therapy needs to remain privileged and confidential, and they're not sure they want to, somebody wants to bring in the therapist, and I'm concerned about preserving the child's relationship with their service provider, then I might appoint minors counsel to help with that determination whether privilege should be waived or not. But what are some other considerations that you make when appointing minors counsel, Commissioner Thomas?
Well, I'm definitely going to look at the age of the child, the maturity, the ability for them to participate with their minors counsel, and at what level. I know that many times I may get the argument, well, the child doesn't want to see a parent, or there's a strong refuse-resist dynamic. I may actually look at the conduct that the child is participating in to figure out whether or not the child has the requisite maturity, or whether I'm going to be enabling or emboldening them in the litigation if I give them their own advocate. I definitely look at the best interest, whether the best interests dictate them having an independent representative. I look at the availability of qualified counsel. I look to funding. So I, to the extent that you raise your hand or you file your motion, tell me what is your thought process in terms of how minors counsel will be paid for? Because to the extent I'm on the fence as to the probative value of a minors counsel, I'm going to look to finances as to why should the county be paying if it's not going to have such a probative effect relative to me determining the issues. And I also realize that there can be less intrusive means through which I can get the information. So I look at all of that in kind of a balancing act because I, as someone who acted as minors counsel, Judge Dujon, you know how intrusive it can be to now have a minors counsel coming into the life of not just the child, but also the child's family digging around for information. And you hope that that can be done the least intrusive way possible. But there's definitely an impact to making that type of order and appointing counsel for the minor child. What about you, Judge Dujon? What considerations do you look to?
Yeah, no, I think they're the same. I think that it's not just intrusive into the child's family. It's also intrusive into the child's school, again, mental health, even sometimes their extracurricular activities. If minors counsel has to talk to coaches, or dance instructors or tutors, I mean, it can be very intrusive into the life of the child, right? So I think that I also like to proceed cautiously with it. And I also consider whether appointing minors counsel will delay the proceedings, or, will it help expedite something in the proceedings, or will it cause unnecessary delay? And I take that into account also when considering whether to appoint minors counsel or not.
Here's my question, Judge Dujon. I had mentioned that my first day, I faced a lot of attorneys kind of raising their hand at the end of the hearing, like, give us minors counsel. Do you entertain that, or do you require minors counsel to be requested with a properly pled and fully noticed request for order?
Well, I certainly wouldn't entertain it when I'm giving my orders, and that's when someone throws the Hail Mary at the end before, it's all pronounced. And I would not entertain that because that's just really not liking the order and trying anything they can to avoid it. But I prefer that it's in a noticed motion so that the other side has notice, has due process. Hopefully, there's a meet and confer, and everyone can discuss it. If there's an agreement, they might even discuss a possible person for the role, and how to pay. But if not, it's something that I'll adjudicate, but there needs to be notice to the other side.
And I would agree with that, given the constitutional concerns when we are appointing a minors counsel. My preference is due process needs to be followed. There needs to be proper notice to the other side, a chance to respond, absent either an agreement or exceptional circumstances. Again, we do this for the best interest of the child. So if best interests dictate, maybe ex parte or what have you, but all things considered, notice to everybody on both sides of counsel table is ideal.
Yes. And so I know we talked about rights and responsibilities, and I think that Commissioner Thomas, maybe if you talk a little bit about the form FL-323, which is the order appointing counsel for child, and just really briefly why it's so important and what it is.
Sure. So, pursuant to Family Code Section 3150, that gives the court the power to appoint. At the time that we're appointing, we should be doing it on this form FL-323, which is the order appointing counsel for a child. Now, this order is going to set forth the reason for the appointment, the determination of fees, how minors counsel is compensated, any additional orders. What I find most important, the reason for appointment I look at is the scope of appointment. I try to be as specific as possible when I'm trying to bring on a minors counsel, and I really want to focus them on what I want them to do. Now, if I don't have specific concerns and I just want advocacy, I might say to investigate and advocate for the best interests of the minor child. But generally, if there are concerns I have, I'm concerned about education, I'm concerned about medical, I need admissible evidence on a certain subject. Provision four of this form is exactly where I'm going to set that forth. And the reason that I like that is because, and as a practice point, When minors counsel is appointed, make sure you understand the scope of their appointment. Now, I'm not saying that scope can't change, but I do think it's important that everybody understands why the minors counsel is there. And I think being able to tailor your advocacy to the minors counsel or their information or even the information you provide on behalf of your client can be very effective to ensuring the outcome that you need. Sonia, any thoughts relative to this form or information that attorneys should be looking for when they receive the order of appointment?
Yeah, no, I think that the scope is re really important, and it falls under number four, which is the reason for the appointment. Sometimes it's very wide. Sometimes the judge really just keeps the scope and the reason very focused. And so everyone needs to be aware of that. FL 323, I think, is crucial for people who are minors counsel because, again, that lays out all the rights and responsibilities. And on the second page, it gives it gives minors counsel the right to records, to obtain school records, to waive privilege, all kinds of things. And that, I know when I was doing minors counsel work, I would use this order to contact the school, to contact therapists, to contact any third party provider that I needed to speak with regarding the minor child. And it's quicker and easier than a subpoena, just for me to at least make contact and let them know who I am. But I think a practice pointer is a lot of attorneys who represent parents either have to do an order after hearing, after minors counsel was appointed at the hearing and minors counsel wasn't there, or sometimes you stipulate to have minors counsel come on the case, and you stipulate as to who it is, and you submit that stipulation, and it's signed with the court. I think a good practice pointer is then also, both with orders after hearings and with stipulations, prepare the FL 323 and submit that to the court as a proposed order for whatever, for the minors counsel appointment. Because it gets everything going and started much more quickly. And it's the form that minors counsel really needs to get started with their work.
I would also advise going over the FL 323 with your clients. It's very important that parents understand what the duties are of minors counsel and what rights the counsel has. For example, reasonable access to the child. It is not helpful for me if I come back or I bring parties back on a hearing, like a review hearing, and the report from minors counsel is I didn't get access to my client, so I couldn't move forward. And the response from counsel table is, well, my client didn't realize that she needed to make or he needed to make the child available. As we can see on the third page, subsection 9A, counsel has the right to have reasonable access to the child. So, to the extent that the order appointing counsel has gone out and everything is as it needs to be, and I have either party arguing that they didn't realize that any of these things needed to happen, it's not going to be wholly persuasive.
Right. And I also think that you have to be careful what you wish for, right? Because the attorney also representing the child needs to inform the court if the child wishes to address the court or has changed their mind and doesn't wish to address the court. And a lot of times, you have the parents that are asking you to get the minors counsel because their child wants to talk to the judge. Their child wants to talk to the judge. And it may not end up being what your client thinks it's going to be, or the child, when they talk to an attorney about it, decides, I really don't want to. It was just my parent that was really putting pressure on me. And now you have minors counsel in your case, and the child doesn't want to address the court. I mean, just be careful what you wish for. There's always a lot of different sides to an issue in a case in family law, and the child's side will now the child's perspective will now come into play. Okay, so Family Code Section 3151 is the code section that really gives the rights and responsibilities for the appointment. California Rule of Court 5.242, it's one of my favorite rules of court, as nerdy as that sounds. It has the requirements for minors counsel, and it details the qualifications that you need to become minors counsel, the training that you should have to become minors counsel, and also it lists the responsibilities of a person who is appointed to represent the child. There are trainings in Los Angeles County that will give you the training that you need to become minors counsel the first time, and then to keep up with the continuing education. Because minors counsel for the first time have to take 12 hours of training, and then every year after that, you have to do 8 hours of training that is designated to specific issues regarding the representation of children, including domestic violence, child abuse, substance abuse, and so on. So there are trainings in Los Angeles County that will give you that training. There are trainings in other counties that will give you that training. And you have to have some experience requirements. And then the rule really lays out also the responsibilities of minors counsel. And it goes a little bit further than Family Code Section 3150 at SEC. So it's a very comprehensive rule. And we put most of the rule in here, but really, if you have questions about it, you should look at it and read it because it's quite lengthy, but full of really good information.
Now,
Yeah.
does the rule cover what minors counsel should do at the time they're appointed?
Yes. So it does. And minors counsel is required to submit a declaration. It's called the Declaration of Counsel for Child Regarding Qualifications. Super creative title. And that needs to be, it's really FL 322, and that needs to be filed within 10 days of receiving your appointment. And Commissioner Thomas just put that up on there. It's for a person who was appointed as minors counsel to confirm that they have received the requisite training and experience, because CRC 5.242 also outlines some experience that you need to have, or alternative experience if you don't have it and you want to start doing the job. So this needs to be filed with the court, and hopefully within 10 days of receiving notice of the appointment to be minors counsel, and ideally it should be served on all parties. So
Would you ever address with counsel, to the extent you don't have a qual deck in the file by the time you bring everybody back, would you ask for it before moving forward, or what is the significance in terms of looking for this document in the file?
well, I think it's important to. I think, are you asking me as far as a judicial officer, or if you were a
Absolutely.
practicing attorney?
As a judicial officer, would not seeing this form in the file prohibit the matter from moving forward?
Not necessarily, no. But I think that I might ask, counsel, have you filed your FL 322? And it depends who the counsel is. Also, if it's counsel that filed it in another case that was in front of me yesterday and didn't file it in this case, I would just ask because it was probably just a clerical error. But it is a mandatory form. Would it prohibit you, Commissioner Thomas, from going forward?
I think that I would handle it the same way. I would probably be a little more leery if it was a council that I didn't have experience with or didn't know their background, because I think the form is very clear in terms of what the education, the training, and the experience needs to be. So, though it wouldn't be a reason for me not to move forward, it may be a reason for me to take a moment, print out the form, and ask council to submit it. Or at least run through their qualifications if it was someone that I am not necessarily familiar with or that I don't understand has the training and the experience. Because I really do want to make sure that anyone that I am appointing or signing off on to represent the minor child is in a position to do no harm and is trained accordingly.
I agree. I agree. So, just really quickly, let's talk about forms of payment for minors counsel, just quickly because it might affect what you ask for. And I think it also helps clarify for the attorneys that represent parents who don't do minors counsel work. Sometimes there's words thrown out by minors counsel on the court that you really don't know what they mean. And that is the PACE rates, right? So minors counsel can be appointed and paid by the County of Los Angeles, which is the PACE program. And PACE currently, they went up. They pay $165 an hour. It used to be a lot less. And it's at when the court appoints minors counsel, and we determine that it will be a PACE appointment, we have to determine at what level. And there are four different levels, and that caps the fees at those levels. And if minors counsel is going to move past that cap, they need to ask the court for an approval to move to the next level. So if you're in a hearing, and minors counsel says, "Your Honor, I need to be moved up to the next PACE level," and you hear any type of conversation with the court about that, that's what that means. If they're appointed at PACE level one, which caps their fees at 1500, I think it might have changed, but let's say it caps their fees at 1500, what they're really saying is, "I need to go to the next level," which caps their fees at 3000. So that should also be with notice to everybody, but I know that a lot of times it might not happen. And that's where it is. And in most cases, the court also reserves jurisdiction to modify or reallocate the fees. And if the court decides that PACE is not going to pay for minors counsel, then the parties will be ordered to pay for the fees of minors counsel, and that can be divided in different ways and be allocated between the parties in different ways depending on their financial forms, right? And hopefully what their I&E show.
Judge Dujon, do you ever convert a PACE appointment to a private pay appointment?
Yes. I have.
Under what circumstances?
Well, it depends. So sometimes people are in front of me and I don't have any financial information about them. And I would like minors counsel to get started working right away if I'm appointing minors counsel. And I will order that their fees be paid by PACE so that they're at least guaranteed they'll be paid, subject to reallocation or subject to be modified. And then I order the parties to file and serve an income and expense declaration 2 weeks before they come back, letting them know that I will be looking to see if that PACE payment needs to be modified or reallocated.
As a practice pointer, at least in my courtroom, and I know that my ethos may be a little different, it is probably more difficult to get a minors counsel appointed in my courtroom than other courtrooms because I just realize that I'm really looking for the probative value. But when you are making your motion or your request for minors counsel, please address compensation with me. It is very difficult. If you bring a motion for a request for minors counsel, and I see both parents represented by fine and not necessarily affordable but expensive counsel, and then the argument is, but there's no money in this case for minors counsel, but we desperately need it, so use the county to pay for it. To the extent that you are bringing any type of motion requesting that, please have your financials in order. And please also explain to me, to the extent that this does need to be a county resource, why, and make sure that I feel good about utilizing that resource appropriately. I think that also ensures your best chance of the court appointing someone in a situation where the court may be on the fence. Judge Dujon, what say you relative to information you find helpful regarding compensation when you're trying to ascertain whether or not to appoint or whether it should be PACE or private pay?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think we need all the information, including how much they're paying in attorney's fees. We need that information to make a determination. And the last thing I want is to appoint an attorney as minor's counsel who is not going to get paid. But at the same time, the county should not be paying for everybody. Especially when there's money going to very competent attorneys.
Well, one thing that we haven't addressed, we discussed PACE compensation. What does it look like in terms of private pay? Like, is that a retainer situation? Will you ever order parents to put down money on a retainer for minors counsel if it's private pay?
I might, or I might just leave it for for minors counsel to set their own retainer. I don't necessarily want to micromanage minors counsel's private pay fees and retainers. So, but sometimes if I feel like that needs to be done, then I would order it. What about you?
So then what would also be helpful is if there's a stipulation or an agreement to a private pay minors counsel, that the information regarding that compensation also be put before the court. We don't have access to information to know necessarily how much a private pay minors counsel is charging, what the retainer looks like, or what that is. So I think just kind of jumping on Judge Dujon's thought process, that it is helpful to us for that information to either be provided, or that may be when you find your PACE appointment is converted to a private pay.
Yeah. So let's talk about the scope of the appointment. Commissioner Thomas, do you write in your appointment orders when you do appoint, do you write anything about the reasons and the scope of the appointment?
Oh yes. Not only I think I find catharsis in writing it out actually, but I will absolutely write out why the appointment order is being made, what my focus is, and what information I'm hoping to get out of it. And even I'll even go as far as if competing allegations have been made in the courtroom, I will even point that out. Mom makes allegations of substance abuse. Dad makes allegations of gatekeeping or alienation. I try to at least highlight what I understand the argument or the issues to be so minors counsel can get a sense of what they're asking for or a sense of where they should be at least starting their investigation. I never want to curtail where the investigation goes unless it's a really limited appointment, but I definitely don't want them to need to read through the 300 pages in the RFO I had to filter through to get a sense of where to start when interviewing their client.
And would you entertain from counsel for the parties, would you entertain what the reason or the scope is before before you create that form?
Oh, absolutely.
And
Absolutely. And in fact, I've even taken stipulations from counsel where they're not necessarily in agreement to a wide sweeping scope for minors counsel, but they'll agree on this limited issue. We're agreeable to minors counsel, which then gets counsel through the door. And then once I have a minors counsel involved, if they feel they need to expand the scope of their appointment, maybe they find out that they need to expand the scope of their appointment, or maybe they find out that their appointment is absolutely fine. But I will always listen to advocacy relative to what the scope should be, because the least invasion I can cause into the family system or the life of the child, I think the better.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. All right. So a lot of time people want minors counsel because they want the children to be heard in court. And that brings us to California Rule of Court 5.250, which is Commissioner Thomas's favorite rule of court.
Oh, it is. Okay, I'm starting to realize through this presentation we may actually need hobbies at this point in time. It's kind of sad when, like, favorite California rules of court. But the reason I love California Rule of Court 5.250 is because it governs the children's participation in testimony in family court proceedings. And really, it was designed to implement Family Code Section 3042, which Judge Dujon will touch on in a moment. But what I enjoy about this is it really gives us some guidance relative to whether we hear from the child, how we hear from the child, who's present, whether parents are in the room, whether they're not, the findings the judicial officer needs to make relative to the parents being in the room or not being in the room. It also gives a mechanism or ideas of ways of determining if the child wishes to address the court or has changed their mind. I can hear that from a minors counsel. I can hear that from a court evaluator, someone from Family Court Services. Subsection C of the rule gives a whole bunch of information relative to determining how to ascertain if a child wishes to address the court. There's also guidelines for determining whether addressing the court is in the children's best interest. Now, these are guidelines. We have a lot of judicial discretion in this area, but it's very helpful for everyone in the room to be aligned relative to the guidelines that guide us. There are also guidelines for receiving the testimony and other input. To the extent that a judicial officer makes a determination that it's not in the child's best interest to testify, and I am a believer wholeheartedly that it is not always in the child's best interest to testify. And experience has shaped that, but also reading cases has definitely formed that opinion. Ultimately, it is helpful for me to understand that there are other options, that apart from hearing from the child directly, there are other parenting plan assessments. Other individuals have the ability to garner the information that we need, even a child interview, which helps in a more delicate or sensitive situation still put the information you need before the court, but doesn't necessarily require the child to come into court. There's also additional responsibilities of court-connected and appointed professionals. So if you're looking at a team approach for how to work with this family or getting information relative or advocacy relative to the child, this is the subsection F is going to guide you. And methods of providing information to parents and supporting children, I think, is very important as an advocacy to familiarize yourself with, which is subsection G. And then subsection H talks a little bit about the expected education and training that the court staff and the judicial officers are expected to have.
Right. And that, I think that goes along with Family Code Section 3042, which talks about preferences of the child and whether a child wishes to address the court and what the court needs to consider, right? The sufficient age, the capacity to reason, and it also outlines how that there's different ways of taking child testimony, and that it really just gives some guidance to judicial officers and attorneys as to how this should be done. And I think, you know, there's a difference between a child testifying as to preference in for custody and visitation. for whatever reasons, for them to testify as to preference versus a percipient witness. And there is, I think, a difference in how the testimony is set up. There's the difference whether how much l really leeway the court has in allowing a child to testify or not allowing a child to testify, whether that testimony is going to be as a percipient witness or preference. And I think a lot of times attorneys forget that part. A percipient witness is a percipient witness. They saw something, they observed, they were a witness to something that they need to testify about. A child who wants to be heard regarding preference is just very different. And that's where I think the court has more discretion to decide whether they do address the court or not and how it's done. But regardless, whether it's a percipient witness or preference, the court really has to control the testimony of or how the testimony is taken of the child because it is a child witness.
I want to get back to something you said there that has been kind of the bane of my existence since I started in this elevated position. Do you believe that judicial officers, is the standard the same relative, and is our discretion the same relative to whether we're taking preference testimony or percipient witness testimony?
Our discretion as to what?
As to whether the child testifies?
I don't think it's the same.
Tell me.
Well, this is our conversation here. If someone comes in and has a child who has a witness who is a child, and it's to an issue that is germane to whatever the hearing or trial is about. And it's really not about preference of custody and visitation, but it's germane to something. I think they have a right, and to call that witness as long as the child has competency, as long as the child is an age where they understand what they're doing. You can't bring in a 4-year-old to testify that they saw mom withdraw a bunch of money from the bank. I mean, that's not going to work. A 4-year-old wouldn't have the competency to do that, right? But I think this comes in a lot when more in terms of domestic violence. And if the child witness any domestic violence between the parents, then I think they're a percipient witness, and that adult has a right to proffer them as a percipient witness. I mean, I'll
And
consider their age and their.
because that different standard applies, I would ask for if you are going to fight against a child being called as a percipient witness in a contempt proceeding or in a domestic violence, be armed with argument, maybe even a pocket brief, and recognize that my standard is not just best interest at that point in time. There are
Exactly.
times that I don't believe it's necessarily in the child's best interest, but the child is the only witness to something horrific, and my hands are tied. So, as much as I may not want to put that child on the stand or hear from them because I'm concerned about re-traumatizing them, there's limited discretion that I can apply to say, no, we're just not hearing from this witness. All I can do at that point is ensure that the testimony comes out in a way that is least damaging to the child. But when you're addressing contempt, and for example, like the Corsi defense, or you're looking at the child testifying as a domestic violence witness, that is a very different standard and needs to be treated very differently than, say, 3042 preference testimony.
I agree. And I don't want everyone to think that we're saying, bring us child witnesses, and this is the way you're going to do your case. That in every family law case, if you bring in the children, We have to take their testimony, and then you're going to prove that your client is right in everything he or she is saying, and the other side is completely wrong. That's not what this is. And I really don't want people to come away thinking, I just have to bring the children as percipient witnesses. It's really truly in specific circumstances that the children are percipient witnesses and really should testify. Right. This isn't for everything. I just want to make
Oh
that clear.
no. And to
But
the extent that we find children who are brought in who shouldn't be brought in, or it's not probative and it's damaging, guess what? If we've got custody and visitation in front of us, that may be a metric where that tips the scales also. My apologies, Judge Duchon, I stepped on your last word there.
no, I just wanted to I'm just wary of the time, and I know we have questions, so we're going to leave time for questions. But when we talk about taking children's testimony, I think that it's really important to bring a spotlight on the case of Cardona versus Soto. And Commissioner Thomas, do you want to talk about this a little bit? Because I think a lot of times attorneys for parents come in, or guardians come in, and they just say, you know, my client says the child really wants to talk to the court. First of all, it's not talking to the court. The child is going to come in and testify, right? But you come in as a parent's attorney and you say, the child really wants to address the court, but they can't do it in front of everyone. They're afraid of the other side because the other side is horrible. And so you need to take them into chambers. They'll talk to you in chambers by yourself. Commissioner Thomas, what do you do with that? Would you do it?
Oh no. And here's why. So in 2024, we have the case of Cardona versus Soto. And in that case, Corina Soto and Jose Cardona had a 12-year-old daughter. Now, Soto brought a domestic violence restraining order against Cardona, alleging that while inebriated, he violently beat her in their daughter's presence. Daughter made an audio recording of the incident and then contacted a relative to ask for help. He also, I think, slapped the daughter. He was arrested and the wife was taken to an emergency room. There were also other allegations within the domestic violence filing. At the hearing, though, the daughter spoke in chambers to the court without a court reporter.
Or
Judicial
anybody else
officer,
present.
oh, exactly. Just one-on-one with the child, has discussion, comes out, does not summarize any of it, and then proceeds to make orders and characterizes, he listens to the recording, speaks to the child, characterizes it all as pretty awful, and then proceeds to grant Soto sole legal and physical custody, denies visitation, issues the domestic violence restraining order. There's an appeal, the appellate court reverses and finds that the trial court violated due process and violated due process because based on the basing the ruling on the interview, but not giving the contents of the interview, we're not having a chance for dad to understand what was said. He had no ability to refute or argue against it. And the court didn't summarize any of the testimony for the parties. So this case is really a cautionary tale for when you are asking for a child to come into court, think through how the testimony is going to be proffered, what that's going to look like. Set the stage for the judicial officer. Now, the judicial officer has the final say, but think through these things because asking merely, can you take the child into chambers one-on-one, no one should be around, is probably not going to be a strong position. And Judge Dijon, I don't know about you, the number of children who start their testimony with a, or somewhere in their testimony, tell me, well, Your Honor, I'll tell you, but I don't want to tell anybody else. If we can go somewhere privately, I'll tell you. It needs to be explained from the get-go that that's not what this process is. And it's
Well,
difficult. Go ahead. Go ahead.
and most importantly, it needs to be explained to the parents or, guardians, whoever is bringing it. You need to let your clients know it's not going to be a private one-on-one chat with the judicial officer. And chances are, well, really, not chances are. Both parties are going to know what the child said. And chances are that even both parties will be in the courtroom when it's being done. You know, perhaps it's done in chambers with a court reporter, and if there's counsel with counsel for the parties present. But eventually, both parties are going to know what the child said, and they need to understand that because I do think that a lot of times attorneys for the parties ask for these things, and it's not something that's appropriate. But and also, when you're asking to have a child address the court, come prepared to tell us a little bit about what that child is like. Do they have special needs? Do they, you know, are they a child that's timid? Are they a child that's outgoing? What's their schedule like? Because if I grant your request, I'm going to want to set it at a time that is the most convenient, if possible, to the child's school. And so I need information. And I think a lot of times attorneys come in just with what their client wants, but not ready to give us enough information to even make any orders regarding what their client wants. So moving on, the duties of minors counsel goes along with the rights of minors counsel. Again, you can look at it in 3151 in FL 323 and in 5.242. So we're not going to spend too much time on that. But here's what you could do. Effective communication with minors counsel, right? When you're representing parties and minors counsel gets appointed, how do you deal with it? Effective communication, good communication is key. First of all, provide minors counsel with relevant documents that you want them to consider and look at. Don't dump boxes and boxes and even like all kinds of financial documents. You're going to make minors counsel weave through things that are not relevant. So provide relevant documents that they can get through. Notify as you're going through the case. Notify minors counsel of any significant changes. Sometimes, you know, minors counsel thinks they know the case and they get to court and they're told something. Respect minors counsel's independence and look at their rights and responsibilities. Minors counsel doesn't have to tell you if they talk to the therapist. They don't have to tell you if they talk to the child's school. They don't even have to tell you what those people said. If it's going to be brought up in court, yes, there needs to be a meet and confer. There needs to be, they need to reveal that. However, if they're speaking with the therapist and the therapist, they decide they're not waiving privilege on behalf of their client, and it's best to preserve that relationship and not say anything, they don't have to tell you. Respect that. But ask them for whatever information they can give you regarding their positions. There should be some open communication, but not manipulation. And again, that communication needs to be civil, respectful, follow the code of ethics. You know, I think a lot of times minors counsel gets threatened, and that doesn't work well. That's not helpful to figuring out what is in the child's best interest. If you go to litigation, Commissioner Thomas, what do you think are the best practices?
Make sure they're involved. If there's an evaluation of the child, they need to be there. Pre-trial, like depositions, minors counsel gets a seat at that table. They need notice. They need to be involved. Discovery, they need to be involved. Settlement talks, the number of times that I'll say go meet and confer, and then even about custody and visitation, bring the parties back and find out that minors counsel was nowhere near that meet and confer. They provide advocacy. They are attorneys. And also, you need to be prepared to examine or cross-examine appropriately based on what the case is. So, if minors counsel is bringing in witnesses, if they're participating in the litigation, which is what they're expected to do, be prepared to advocate accordingly. We don't expect you to co-sign on whatever minors counsel says, but to the extent that you're pushing back, we expect advocacy in pushback and we expect legal arguments.
So practical considerations, right? So again, include minors counsel in ex parties, in settlement negotiations or settlement talks, in visitation discussions. Not only could they add something that would be really helpful, but if you reach an agreement and you don't have minors counsel signature on it, it's most likely not going to get signed by the court. If you bring an ex parte and you didn't give minors counsel notice, it's most likely going to get rejected for lack of notice. They are an attorney on the case. They have rights. Again, go back and read them, and they need to be included. Have your clients not prepare their children for the interviews with minors counsel. One of the worst things that I would think as an attorney representing an adult is for the child to go in and say, "Well, my mom said to tell you this," or "My dad said that I need to tell you that." That doesn't bode well for your client, right? And I think what's really helpful is if you reach out to minors counsel or your client reaches out to minors counsel and says, "What would you like my client to tell the children about before coming to meet with you, or before you come to meet with them? How could my client explain who you are before you come here?" And for those of you that have never taken the Minors Counsel training program, at least the LA County one, Minors Counsel is taught how to explain their role to a child in a child-focused way. So they will do it when they first meet the child. And I think what could be difficult is how does the parent or the adult tell the child, "Oh, we're going to this meeting, and who is this person?" Or, "This person is coming to meet you." Reach out to minors counsel and just ask. Every attorney that represents children has their own way that they may want a parent to tell a child about their meeting. And again, just help your clients provide relevant information to minors counsel. I think that helps the process move along. So you've had the hearing. These are common pitfalls to avoid. Remember, minors counsel represents the child, not the parties. Minors counsel is not a shortcut to discovery. Minors counsel has all the privileges that you have as an attorney, right? Work product, it's their work product. You don't get it necessarily. Minors counsel can't go into court and speak for your client or help you present your case. They're presenting their case, they're speaking for the child. And minors counsel has access to a lot of, or may know a lot of resources just because if they do the job a lot, but they're really not a social worker and should not be treated as such. Commissioner Thomas, anything you want to add?
Well, and as we're talking about not a shortcut to discovery, minors counsel is not a witness. It is actually the order appointing counsel has been amended to include that, and it's part of the code. Minors counsel is not a witness, should not be called as a witness, and to do so is very problematic. Now, since we're talking about pitfalls, why don't we get into AF versus Jeffrey and end on that note before we close out and look at the chat for any questions? Because I think AF v. Jeffrey is definitely a pitfall that we need to be mindful of.
Right. So AF versus Jeffrey F or versus Jeffrey, and you need to look at it. It's actually, I think, a 2023 case, but you need to look at it. There were more than one because there were a number of appeals on this case. And this was where there was a minors counsel appointed in the dissolution action, and then the minor child brought a DV proceeding on her own against her father. And the first appeal deals with the minor child hired their own lawyer and the judge disqualified that lawyer, and there was an appeal on that. But then the trial court appointed or expanded the scope of minor's counsel to include representing the minor in prosecuting the restraining order she brought for herself. I believe she was 11 or 12 at the time, maybe even younger, but What the Court of Appeal found in AF versus Jeffrey is that the statute makes it clear the appointment of minors counsel occurs in custody or visitation disputes pursuant to Family Code 3150 and not in a DVRO proceeding. A neutral minors counsel in a dissolution matter plays an entirely different role than counsel hired in a civil matter, which is what the child was trying to do in this case. Minors counsel has a statutorily imposed duty to represent what the attorney believes is in the child's best interest, as well as the child's wishes. And that's straight from the appellate court. But in a civil matter, attorneys representing minors are bound by the Business and Professions Code, the state bar rules of professional conduct, and they have an obligation to zealously represent their client's interests within the bounds of the law. So the court found that it was not appropriate to appoint minors counsel under Family Code 3150 for a child bringing her own restraining order to prosecute that restraining order. And I think this is important because I know a lot of attorneys, when you're representing parents, you find out, or you may know, that the child filed their own restraining order. And a lot of times you think that, oh, well, we'll have minors counsel appointed and they'll prosecute the restraining order. And AF versus Jeffrey found that that's just not appropriate. That's not how it works. Unfortunately, what it also means is if people don't have money to hire a lawyer, that child may have to do it by themselves, or they could have a guardian ad litem appointed, which is different than a minor's counsel. And but I know that happens a lot. And when I was working as minor's counsel, I would get called by attorneys asking if I could be available to take a case where the minor child brought their own restraining order, and that's no longer allowed. The court doesn't say if there's minor's counsel and the minor's counsel believes that they need to file a restraining order on behalf of their client. The court doesn't talk about that. However, that I think the argument could be made that would be done, that would be in the best interest of the minor child if the attorney appointed under 3151 is bringing that action. So it leaves a little bit of room open, but that's really what that case says. And if you're in that situation, you should get to know it because it's a different standard. So I think at this point, even though we may have a few more things, we should answer some questions. Mr.
Absolutely. And the
Thomas.
first question, Judge Dujon, is it appropriate for minors counsel to request an evaluation, either a PPA or a CCE, a parenting plan assessment or a child custody evaluation?
I think it could be. And Family Code 3151 says that you can. You could even request, or minors counsel, not you, minors counsel can request psychological evaluations of their client, mental health evaluations of their client. I think if it's in their client's best interest, they certainly can.
This is an interesting question. Often I see minors counsel giving a report to the court on what the child told them. You said you have to make decisions on admissible evidence. Wouldn't minors counsel's report be hearsay and inadmissible?
Well, minors counsel's report is not hearsay. I mean, it's not evidence, right? It is hearsay. A lot of times, I know judicial officers will ask for a Sanchez waiver when they're appointing minors counsel, or if attorneys are asking for minors counsel to be appointed, will ask if they will waive Sanchez. Minors counsel can make argument on behalf of their client, but really it is hearsay. And but it's the same hearsay that attorneys representing the adults stand up and start arguing a bunch of facts, right? Or that's not admissible evidence, that's coming straight from the attorney. So it's in that same way.
So,
Do
but yeah.
you take the report as an offer of proof? Sorry to
I
step on you
do.
again.
I do.
If minors counsel is appointed and will be paid privately, is it appropriate or acceptable for minors counsel to have their own stipulation in order that covers any issues beyond the FL-323 form? Or is it better that minors counsel put that out in a letter to counsel and parties and request they acknowledge it?
You know, I don't know if we can answer that because it might go towards the it really, I think some of it is case specific, but some of it might be ethical concerns.
I
Commissioner
think what
Thomas.
we can say is that minors counsel, they're attorneys. They went to law school, they are counsel, and they get the autonomy to function like any other attorney would function. We merely appoint them by bringing them into the case, and if they're privately paid, then they have the autonomy to conduct that transaction however is ethical and appropriate, just like any other attorney.
And I think you can look at the case of Metzger, which talks about the appropriateness of fees, of private pay fees for minors counsel, if you need to.
If counsel for their client has their own concerns for the minor based on new facts obtained from their client, can they file a request on their own accord? If not, what is the best course of action for that attorney?
You can certainly file a new request on the adult client's own accord. You could also reach out to minors counsel. If there's something new that came up that you have a concern based on new facts, reach out to minors counsel and let them know and ask if they can look into it and get back to you. You know, sometimes that's a quicker way to deal with things or a better way, but you can also file. You can certainly file a new request.
And I'm also putting a cite to the marriage of Metzger in the chat. If you know that minors counsel has had limited access with the minors on the case, or you're having a difficult time getting a response or filing from minors counsel prior to the hearing, is that something that can be raised at the hearing? And is there a way to see how much minors counsel is billing on a case when it's being billed through PACE?
I don't know if there's a way for you to see the PACE. It used to be before it was electronic. I don't know. I would suspect that if you ask, you should be able to get it. I think, let me see, where is that question?
Oh, it just disappeared. My apologies. I
Oh.
checked it as answered. So it's in the
It
answered.
sounds like this is concerns about minors counsel's work. And I think the first thing you should do is call minors counsel or write them an email and say, look, I have some concerns. I'd like to discuss them with you before we go to court, or before I have to bring them up with the court. And that's just so that not only do you give notice, but you might also find out that minors counsel has actually been doing things that you don't know about. And if not, you can bring it up to the court. I would just say be careful and proceed cautiously and gently when you do that, because you don't want the conflict to become between you and minors counsel and take away also from your client and the children's needs.
So, California Rules of Court Rule 5.241, which requires the court to set compensation, this section outlines the procedure for determining the compensation. You cannot leave it to minors counsel to set the rate. I do not disagree with that. However,
Right.
if it's private pay, we can honor the rate as historically set by minors counsel in their appointment. But that is absolutely a correct statement. Would the same standard apply if a 15-year-old child wants to testify regarding preference as to custody? I think the standards that we went through, I think, would apply to considerations for any child wanting to testify regarding custody, but especially I think 3042 at the age of 15, I think there's a built-in presumption that they should be addressing the court and they should be allowed to address the court. Correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Dushan.
No, I think you're right. I would agree with you. Not that I'm the know-it-all, but I would agree with you.
I'll recognize you as the know-it-all.
No, please don't.
And the final question, can the court appoint minors counsel where a young child is not being asked to testify, but has witnessed things and is in therapy with a disputed diagnosis?
Absolutely, I would think so. Especially the disputed diagnosis. Depending on what it is, I mean, this is very case specific, so there might be more facts to make a different determination, but those are two issues right there that might give rise to the appointment of minors counsel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well,
Well,
with that, I do not see that there are any additional questions. Is there any parting wisdom you would like to impart on our crowd, Judge Sujan?
No, I think we've gone over our time, so I really apologize for that. I just think that you can have a really good working relationship with minors counsel, and even if they're not advocating exactly what your client wants, it could be very helpful to you in your case. Just make sure you know what their rights and responsibilities are, and you're able to work with them. And
And
thank
remember
you.
that they are people and attorneys too. Treat them
Yes.
accordingly. But
Thank
thank
you for
you.
watching.
Thank you for being here.
Alrighty, this concludes today's presentation. Thank you so much, Judge Dujon and Commissioner Thomas, for joining us today. And of course, thank you to our audience. Have a good afternoon.